The Tom Woods Show, episode 2096.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to be joined once again by our old friend Andrew Heaton, who has 10 times the broadcasting voice your host here has. and way, way more of a developed sense of humor as well. I am just condemned, Andrew, to be the straight man, given the kinds of the friend set I have. I'm just condemned. No matter how funny I am, I'm always a straight man.
It's that you're frighteningly sane. That's the problem, Tom. You're too sane. And so the rest of the world just sort of pivots around you in a maelstrom of tumult.
Do you remember years ago doing an escape room with Dave Smith and me and Michael Malice?
Yes.
What fun that was?
Yes. Oh, yeah, that was great fun.
It was
yeah.
just hilarity the whole time. As you would imagine, an escape room with all of us together would be.
It's funny for me, too, because like, and I'm sure you feel the same way, where Dave and Michael are both very publicly evocative figures. And so when people find out, they're like, you're friends with these people? And I'm like, I've done an escape room with them. Yeah. Like, in my mind, these are just my friends that I've had to escape a novelty thing in New York with.
That is like the ultimate thing to be able to say you've done. We've done an escape room. We put our heads together.
Yeah, anything more than that, we should be married. That's as close as for heterosexual men could get.
Well, you are the host of the Political Orphanage podcast. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been with Reason Magazine. You produce an awful lot of content. You're a comedian. So first of all, I love the name The Political Orphanage, although I love it in the abstract, but I can see how in principle it's a hard sell because most people are tribal and they, whatever camps exist, they're going to try to meld themselves into one of them.
Yeah. I came up with a name for why you would probably infer, which is I have worked in partisan media before and I'm very tired of partisan media and I am exhausted by people who see the entire world as red team versus blue team. You and I aren't on red and blue team. We're existing in that. And like, and I feel pretty strongly that I don't want to have my political paradigms dictated to me by a bunch of dead Frenchmen. Maybe I'm not on that spectrum. And I find it very like, I find it too reductive, the whole left versus right thing. Like if you were to try and explain all religion as Protestant versus Catholic, you'd be like, well, okay, there's also Buddhists and Jews and things, right? So I wanted to
And then sort of, even within the Protestants, there's a million different kinds.
Exactly. Yeah. So I feel that that red team, blue team, rock 'em, sock 'em robots really becomes reductive. It just becomes about the fight rather than the ideas. And I'm more concerned about the ideas than I am about the fight itself. So in that capacity, the name of The Political Orphanage has been great. The downside to it is twofold. One, my show's not actually that focused on politics. It's focused on policy and ideas and how people think. I really don't spend a lot of time getting into like, oh, this guy's going to win the Senate election and that guy's... I don't do a whole lot of that. So I think a lot of people that are just kind of burnt out on politics don't want to come in for that reason. And I'm like, no, and I'm actually bringing in a bunch of cool thinkers and authors and things like that. And then the other reason, yeah, the big one, Tom, is if I were to rename the show Drinking Libtard Tears with Andrew Heaton, I would immediately appeal to a particular demographic. It'd be very easy to send up a Batman signal.
But you'd hate yourself. You'd hate yourself.
I would hate it, yeah. And like, say that if I were also to name it like Fight the Fascist Bigots of the South or something, like whatever it is, right? Where it's like there's a clear enemy that I hate.
Yeah.
It's very easy to animate people that way. I would hate doing it. I wouldn't want to do it. So I kind of view myself as the eye of the storm and occasionally people fall in and are very relieved. And then I'm like, welcome, you can hang out now.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Well, okay, so today you're actually bringing some interesting mainstream analysis to the table because when you were in college, however many years ago, apparently you studied international relations. Now,
In fact, I have a master's degree.
Whoa, I'm sorry, I forgot that.
You would not think this for a comedian, but I actually was doing stand-up. Fun biographical detail for people. I was getting a master's degree in international politics from the University of Edinburgh while beginning stand-up comedy, and I was the house comedian at Edinburgh Saturnalia at night. So during the day, I would study international relations theory, which we can talk about. And at night, I would tell jokes in between a guy that ate light bulbs and a girl who took her clothes off. And I feel like this was a really good period of my life.
I know we're supposed to be talking about international relations, but we're going to get to that. But As somebody who was planning and indeed had airline tickets for a trip to Scotland in 2020 and was for obvious reasons not able to take that trip, can you just take a minute to share what it's like living there?
Oh, it's great. Come visit me. So I now live in Austin, Texas, Tom, but I don't like sweating. And Texas is pretty good for that. So I am fully intending to be in Scotland this summer from mid-June through September. And I am a two-time former tour guide in Edinburgh. Like, I say this in complete humility, tour guide is the most competent I've ever been at anything, including comedian, podcast host, and lover. I am a much better tour guide than I am all those other things. So truly, come, like, you have an open ticket. Come visit, and I will show you a fun time and show you around the city. You and I can salute the statue of Adam Smith. We can talk about the invisible hand. We can go check out the grave of David Hume. The Enlightenment largely started in Edinburgh. There's all sorts of fun stuff there. And it's just a really fun town. It's a really fun town. And I would be delighted to escort you around. And yes, it's a great place to live. It's a wonderful town. Edinburgh is fantastic.
Wait, hold on. By the way, you think I'm not going to take you up on this, but I'm seriously thinking about it. So you would actually be there through... When would you be heading back to the U.S.?
I mean, as of now, I think I'm booked to come back like September 31st or October 1st, one of those two. But I will definitely be there July, August, and September.
The thing is, I think Scotland was pretty severe when it came to COVID things. And I don't know how much they've lifted and how much they have in place.
You're right. They were very severe to the point where you could, I think, leave your house an hour a day. That was it. You were permitted to leave your house an hour a day during the height of lockdown. And you could not even go in someone's yard. So like, you were not allowed to go set up lawn chairs and hang out in a courtyard with people with sneezing distance, which you would be fine. If you're 12 feet away, you can't catch Ebola from each other, let alone COVID. But like, that wasn't even allowed. They were very intense about it. They did peel it back. And to my, all this stuff's kind of up in the air, but I believe they've now basically stopped all restrictions. So I came over during the summer. I usually go there every year, but I skipped, you know, a couple of years due to the pandemic. I came back this summer, and the rule at the time was if you were vaccinated, you could just come in, take a test when you got there. And if you were negative, you were good to go. They wouldn't make you do anything. Whereas previously, like a year before that, I'd thought about coming over, but I was going to have to, regardless, they were going to make me quarantine for 10 days. I was going to have to fly to Edinburgh and stay in a government hotel for 10 days. And I was like, I'm not doing that. 2-week vacation.
Right.
I think now it's pretty much like going over there. Although I don't know if they still have the vaccine restriction or not. I don't know what the status is with that.
We'll have to find out. I mean, obviously we know that in England that's been lifted because I'm going there. I'm going to London in July for a week.
Well, then you'll be fine because if you come up from London to Edinburgh, there won't be any international barriers to you. So you're okay there. The Scots also have this weird thing. I'm going to get into some minutiae here. Like, Scotland has a vested interest in always doing different things than England because the quasi-socialists running the Scottish government are also separatists. So they always have a bone to pick. They can't just go, oh, England's doing a pretty good job, but they're all right, I guess. They need to be able to go, oh, look at England. They don't care about you. We care about you. We should be our own country. So like if England lifts its restrictions, then the Scots will increase their restrictions and play it up as England's being dangerous. And if England increases its things, then the Scots will be like, oh, they're too authoritarian. We should, like, they're very reactive, in my opinion. That said, if you fly into London and go from London to Scotland, you've already gone through all of the barriers that you're going to experience. So there's no issue for you there.
Well, I'm going to be with two or three of my kids, and I just want to show them around London. But I was thinking about, by the way, this is going on ridiculously long. I just realized, wait, you know the other guy you should meet? We're actually recording a podcast here.
Do you know Dominic Frisby? Because you would
love Dominic Frisby. Yes.
Dominic's a great guy. Yes. He's in London, right?
He totally is. We had a great lunch last night. He's been on this show before. But anyway,
let me know when you're down there because I'll fly down just to get a pint with you and Dominic Frisby.
But I'm thinking of September to actually go to Scotland proper.
Great. Yeah, yeah.
So I'll get back with you. If you're going to be there through September, early September, I might do it.
Yeah, you can all stay with me. The kids can stay on the couch. You and I'll go head to toe in bed.
Well, this one might be just the old man. So we'll see.
Okay, cool.
We'll see. Nice. But anyway, all right, everybody. Look, for whoever's still listening, we're going to talk about the actual subject matter here. I hope I have no new listeners on this episode. This guy never even gets to the point. So we were talking about international relations theory. Just yesterday, I had on the program somebody who is a business school student, and he came on to talk about kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly about business school. That business schools are where, let's say, Austrian school scholars sometimes find a fairly congenial home. among mm-hmm. the faculty, and they fit in because there's a great emphasis on entrepreneurship within Austrian economics.
Right. It's like 10 to 1 as opposed to 100 to 1
exactly.
in terms
right.
of the free market
and,
people.
And people
yeah.
genuinely appreciate the Austrian insights about entrepreneurship at a business school. Mm-hmm. But yet, there are still some issues to be discussed with regard to business school. Well, likewise here, international relations theory, right away, I'm skeptical about this.
Yeah.
But there
well,
are...
First of all, it sounds really boring. I promise we'll make this engaging.
Oh, it's not that I'm skeptical we can make it interesting. It's that I wonder about abstractions mm-hmm. with flesh and blood issues like international relations.
Right.
But I want to look at the different ways, the different schools of thought mm-hmm. deal with this and then see what the pluses and minuses are and
great.
And how they work. So as somebody who has a master's degree in this, give us like a dumb guy overview of the main schools of thought.
Perfect. Great. Well, and actually, I'll back up a little bit before then because I am assuming that the majority of your listeners are libertarian and have a heady non-interventionist streak in them, or at least a very heavy skepticism of alliances and intervention. All of that's fine. But we need to make a distinction between foreign policy, which is what we plan to do, or what is in the best interest, how many bombs should we get, what alliances should we be a part of, and international relations theory. IR theory is kind of the tectonic level underneath all of this. And basically what IR theory is looking to address is not the normative side of this, that is to say, like a lot of libertarians kind of view non-intervention as an extension of NAP. Right? Of like, I don't want to coerce other people, therefore our country shouldn't coerce other people. And that's fine. But that we're making kind of a moral argument right there, right? So international relations theory is really concerned with the DNA of war. It's about why does conflict arise between states? Why do countries go to war? How do we avoid war? And even, and this is where I make it fun for the libertarian on us, even if the answer to both is because of states and states are bad and we shouldn't have states, great. The final part of this is, all right, but how do we predict what authoritarian regimes are going to do? How do we infer what Russia's apt to do? Because that's still going to inform what we do or what our allies should be doing, right? So in that regard, I'd say that the big three that you really see play out in foreign policy circles are realism, liberalism, and Marxism. And all three of those are means by which to try to figure out why is friction happening between states and how do we mitigate it?
Okay, so... Of course, there are going to be different ways of thinking about that. So there will be some. Now, you could say Marxists say this, but maybe also libertarians as well to some degree. That it all
There's a lot of overlap between the libertarians and the Marxists. And I don't want to make anybody's head explode. That doesn't mean you're in favor of like state-controlled property, but it does mean the Marxists tend to look at IR theory as going, look, the predominant friction going on is the ruling class trying to make a buck. That's what Marxists think. So like, if you think the war in Iraq was all about oil, that's a Marxist way of looking at things. And I think if you were just to say crony capitalist, all of a sudden you have a lot of ideological overlap or heuristic overlap between like Ron Paul and a lot of these folks. So there is a fair amount of overlap.
Yeah. And I think it's just customary for Marxists when listening, let's say, to some theoretical exposition about why international actors behave the way they do, to just want to brush it aside and say, you know, all your highfalutin language and theoretical apparatus that you have here is nice and all, but let's get down to what's really going on. And mm-hmm. what's really going on is, you know, et cetera, right? That, you know, that there's yeah. something beneath the surface.
Right. And so like where this all becomes less abstract and less theoretical is when there are actually shooting wars going on or about to be. So like Ukraine is an example of this where when everything's great and everybody's at peace, this is all very academic jargon and it's all just models and people and suits arguing with each other. But like in the case of Ukraine, there's a really big dividing line right now between do we back off and give Russia space or do we conversely try to help and enfranchise Ukraine into NATO and the European Union? And these are mutually exclusive paths and they're ones which have really big implications because we're flirting with thermonuclear war. And like with Marxists, they don't have a big footprint in American foreign policy. But in terms of how they would look at it, they would basically go, yeah, all this talk about like the free world versus the authoritarians and all this stuff, that's all nonsense.
Or human rights.
Yeah,
they would just not believe that.
They would say that's all a smokescreen. What it's about is there's a big gas line between Russia through Ukraine to Germany. And that is something that people are worried about. America and the West want to have open markets and free labor and are trying to pry open Ukraine like a clam. I think that the Marxist would say something like that, that this is about a buck. Or they might look at it, and this is again where there's a lot of overlap with the libertarians, and go, look at most international conflicts, you're going to see right behind it Lockheed Martin. And Northrop Grumman, or however you say that, and like defense contractors looking to make a buck, and that these are illusory conflicts that are being drummed up by people looking to make money.
All right. So talk to me more about the realists, because I think a lot of libertarians tend to think of the realists as the second best. If we can't have a libertarian analysis,
right,
well, then sometimes the realists have some valuable insights.
Yeah. So when we use these terms, I want to caution people both with realism and liberalism. These have a specific connotation in IR theory that are unrelated to how we would use it conversationally normally. So whenever you see a presidential debate, foreign policy comes up, all of the presidents will say, you know, I'm a realist. And what they mean is, I'm a pragmatist seer who's looking through the fog of my opponent's idiocy to see how the world really is. What they mean is, I am a smart, pragmatic thinker. When we say realism, that's not what we mean. We don't mean pragmatic as opposed to non-pragmatic. In the same way, when we say liberal, we don't mean liberal as in a liberal Democrat or a progressive. Liberal in this context really means sort of enlightenment thinking. It means John Locke, Adam Smith, Immanuel Kant, and sort of contrasting that with the older realists. But anyway, so realists, their thing is states exist in an anarchic system. There is no super government. There is no global judge or global mayor or global police force. There's just states. We're all in the old West with guns pointed at each other. And all international relations is between these actors with guns pointed at each other. And we're deluding ourselves if we pretend there's anything else going on beyond that. All of the states are afraid of being dominated. They're all in this Mexican standoff in an old-timey saloon. We're all afraid we're going to get shot and mugged if we don't keep our guns pointed at everybody else. And so we need to be aware that power politics are the main dynamic between states. The states don't want to be dominated, and they want to dominate, and they primarily want to survive. That survival of the regime is the top international relations priority of every single regime. And that power is the big thing. So like a realist would look at this talk about human rights and the free world versus the authoritarian world, and Biden talking about how we've got to help the Democrats and the liberals in Ukraine. And they would go, yeah, that's really great. Hey, aren't we allies? Aren't you flying down to Saudi Arabia next week to comfort our allies who are a bunch of despotic, authoritarian, homophobic, hereditary dictator? Like, and to a realist, you could be like, look, we acknowledge we need the oil and we want stability. We're not claiming we're friends with these people because of any values. That's all a smokescreen. It's just about power, right? So realists are thinking that. And realists would look at Ukraine, for example, and Russia and go, Ukraine is Russia's historic backyard, the same way that Canada and Mexico are America's historic backyard. It sucks that we live in a world where large states get to push around tiny states. That is the world we find ourselves in. If China wanted to put Air Force bases in Mexico and Mexico said that they were open to it, we would invade Mexico and we would stop them from doing that. If Russia wanted to put in military bases in Vancouver and Canada wanted to do it, we would take over Vancouver. And that's basically what's happening. So the realists look at this and go, not making a statement about the ethical validity of Vladimir Putin, not saying that he's a moral guy or a good guy, just in terms of physics, in terms of billiard balls, we have hit the billiard balls in a way that provoked him to invade Ukraine. And the smart play, according to a realist, would be we should back away and make sure that Russia and China don't ally and kind of play a Nixon card, which is different than liberals.
When you say you're defining what a realist is, I mean, wouldn't we? It seems that in their analysis, they don't just describe the way things tend to work and that this is the way states are, but they also do seem to want to put a damper on what we might call, I don't think it's even really a school of thought, but we might call so-called idealists,
yeah,
or people in the Woodrow Wilson camp, mm-hmm, because it seems like the realists, I think they're also being true to the name in trying to lower people's expectations of what's possible to achieve in the world through foreign policy.
Very much so. You just skipped about 3 months of IR theory that I had to read through with that very canny observation. Yeah. So like both realism and liberalism sort of trace their progenitors as going back several hundred years. But in terms of when these philosophies were actually articulated and taught in academia and taught in foreign policy schools and Council on Foreign Relations and all those guys, right? When they actually come into their own as a thing people study, happens around World War I, World War II. And what effectively happens is World War I happens. Woodrow Wilson, who is an idealist, you know, he's the savior of Europe and he's the head of this transatlantic alliance. And he and the other idealists basically took the opinion of, hey, like the world's becoming more democratic, it's becoming more scientific, it's becoming more liberal. We can outlaw war. We can do these things. you know, the world has been in this anarchic system of power play dynamics and Otto von Bismarck and Cardinal Richelieu. And look what it got us. It got us World War I. It got us the worst conflict in all of human history. So we need to step up and design a system that will make war itself illegal and ensure that conflict is mitigated through diplomacy and international relations. And we are going to do this and move on from that. They were literally called idealists. And the realists went, you guys are nuts. You are nuts and you are going to lead us right off a cliff by not looking at what's actually happening. And then lo and behold, Hitler starts moving into Czechoslovakia and then into Belgium and into France. And the system didn't work. And the realists basically went, you literally tried to stop Hitler through a club that people could join and take off from voluntarily that had no force of law to it. And yeah, the realists would say, look, we're not claiming that this is the best world to live in, but the world we actually live in is one where power dynamics are the 90% of this equation. And at the end of the day, the best way to achieve peace is to have such a strong deterrent that people don't want to attack you. And so we want to have a big armed force or we want to have a nuclear bomb, but we basically want to bare our teeth enough that someone doesn't look over at us and go, I could use your 10. You know, and I could use that city in my empire, and I'm going to think twice about it. And it's going to be kind of crummy because we're going to have all this money going into armament buildup and that kind of thing. But the alternative is Hitler invades you, or Russia expands indefinitely, and all that kind of stuff.
Hey, everybody, let's take a quick minute to thank our unbelievably great sponsor, Persist SEO. It will help you out of a rut if your business is not going in the direction you want to see it go. So, if you're getting buried by your competition online, you can build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO. Or if you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, you can increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or what if you're not getting any leads coming in on a consistent basis, or you can count them on one hand? Well, the website search engine and conversion optimization that Persist SEO offers can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. And if you're tired of cold calling, and frankly, who isn't, you can use your website as a lead generation engine. And if you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help. for a free website audit and consultation. That's ineedseo.help. Can you give us some names, just a few names of reasonably well-known scholars who are associated with these various traditions?
Yeah, so the big guy right now with realism is John Mearsheimer. And John Mearsheimer would more eloquently explain what I just said about Ukraine and Russia, that Russia invading Ukraine is a predictable result of Western hubris and verbal window dressing, that we have been deluding ourselves into thinking that this is all about ideology and that this is all about human rights and expanding the Western order and all these things, that's all nonsense. And we have just marched off a cliff and we are now flirting with World War III. John Mearsheimer would be, I think, the most recent example of that. If we go back a little bit further, Henry Kissinger is a very good example of a realist, and Richard Nixon's a good example of a realist. Most of the presidents we've had in my lifetime save Trump. Actually, all of the presidents in my lifetime save Trump, I would say, have been liberals. Again, liberal has a different connotation here. So like George W. Bush, Biden, and Obama all come out of the same theoretical background in how countries work. They're all liberals. Whereas Nixon is a realist, and he has that kind of more gritty, sorry, kid, this is how it is, which is why he goes to China and he reverses American foreign policy, where previously the American government did not recognize the People's Republic of China as the legitimate government of China. We saw them as an illegitimate regime. The real legitimate de jure regime of China is the Republic of China in Taiwan. And Nixon went, guys, this is dumb. We need to acknowledge that Beijing is in control of all of mainland China. We would rather have that regime we don't like be friends with us and not team up with the Soviet Union than keep up this absurd charade that Taiwan is the real government of China. So Nixon's a good example. Then you go further back, Otto von Bismarck, Cardinal Richelieu, people who think of nation states very much in Westphalian terms as a billiard ball that I am going to try to ally with whoever to stop other people from dominating me. Those are all very realist ways of thinking.
Now, the purpose of these various theories is, because you were saying in your email to me that libertarians tend to look at the normative side of foreign policy. You know, this is right, this is wrong, we should be non-interventionist, we should follow these certain principles. But our theory is positioned more to predict the way states will in fact act. And then knowing that, maybe we can fashion policies that will get them to act in the ways we want.
Yes.
So how exactly does that work? And does it work?
Yeah, and great point. I think that this is why, I think this is fun to talk to libertarians about, because it is sort of a, it's an opportunity to find a new thing to think about and kind of figure out where you position yourself. I don't know that there is a clear-cut corollary for libertarians, the same way that like, we can look at like, I don't know, if you're a libertarian on social issues, you're probably also a libertarian on economic issues, right? So there are these correlations you can do across the political spectrum. IR theory is almost like, to get really into the weeds here, if we're doing the political compass, we're doing the Nolan square, and there's the x-axis and the y-axis, and the x-axis is how much economic intervention we want, the y-axis is how much social intervention we want. IR theory is kind of a z-axis that's unrelated to these two things. So you could be a libertarian and kind of follow along any of these, as far as I can tell. And that is why I think IR theory is important aside from these. If you're really big on the non-aggression principle and you're really skeptical of states and intervention and all these things, that's great. But that's not useful in terms of predictive analysis. Saying that I think that state coercive action is illegitimate and immoral doesn't tell you what Putin's going to do. It just tells you that Putin's a bad guy. And IR theory helps fill that in. So in terms of what can IR theory predict, we got to go into the next big one, which is liberalism. So realists are all about power dynamics, and they're looking and going, basically, the international stage wants to have a homeostasis. If there's one really big player in continental Europe, the other tiny players will all band up and form a coalition to try and counteract that guy, like in World War I, and that's kind of constantly happening. So realists are looking at the world stage going, America's not going to be in charge of everything forever. Eventually, Russia and China are probably going to rise up, and there's going to be a three-way tie going on in international politics. The way liberals think is power is important. Let's say it's 70% of the equation. Realists have got the bulk of it down, but there's an additional 30% that is very much influenced by markets and democracy. So liberals look at this and say, when two countries are trading with each other and they're engaging in commerce, they are less likely to go to war. Walmart is the largest trading partner of China. And for that reason, China is probably not going to go to war with the United States. It's really going to think hard about it because it will be economic suicide for them if they do it. The more trade you have going on in Europe between Belgium and France and Germany, the less likely the businessmen in these very countries are going to want to go to war with each other. And then that also charts democratically, where the theory is that democratic regimes view each other as more legitimate than they view authoritarian regimes. So they're less likely to be worried about other democratic regimes invading them. And they're also going to suffer war weariness more readily than dictatorships are. Because if you have a democratic regime and everybody's having to do rations and they're getting taxed more and they're getting conscripted, they're eventually going to wear out and vote in another party. Whereas an authoritarian regime can go on forever. So liberals in IR theory basically go, the best way to, whereas the realists would say you just want to have a lot of armaments to deter people and then recognize zones of influence, liberals would say the best way for us to achieve peace and to mitigate these conflicts is to try and enfranchise people into our system of open markets and democratic elections. And that when we do that, they join our peaceful worldview and become a cooperative element of what we call the free world, and they're less likely to cause conflicts with each other. And they can point to, say, like the European Union. Now, you and I probably have some serious problems with the technocracy of the European Union in terms of how they govern themselves, but they've been successful in keeping Germany and France from going to war with each other. They haven't gone to war with each other since they joined the EU. And so, again, where the conflict happens here is liberals would say this is a conflict between the democratic open markets of the world and the authoritarian closed markets of the world. What we need to be doing is enfranchising Ukraine into our system. We need to get them to join the EU. We need to think about having them join NATO. And we need to try and push Putin out of Ukraine to help this democratic regime remain free. Whereas realists would say, all you're doing is provoking the bear when you do that. You're deluding yourself.
Listening to all this, I'm trying to think about how this would have applied, this type of analysis, during the Cold War. Because I think some of the conflict that exists right now between realists and so-called liberals, liberals in the classical sense, of course.
Right, yeah.
I think goes back to the fact that there was some confusing overlap between them during the Cold War because they happened to more or less come to the same policy conclusion. So liberals would say, you know, the communists are responsible for outrageous crimes against humanity and, you know, we have to restrain them and this and that. And the realists would say the communists are trying to spread their influence politically and militarily around the world, and we need to stop them. You know, so that you would get a Bill Kristol being on the side of a Pat Buchanan. But then after this is over, the realists say, all right, well, now we don't have an ideological monolith like this anymore. And now we can kind of pick and choose what our foreign policy is. It's not kind of dictated to us by what some other force is doing. Whereas the liberals, I think, kind of continued in their pattern of, well, we want to keep this power in check because of X, Y, and Z reason. Whereas the realists were saying, but this isn't really our fight, and this is not what international relations is all about.
I am very bothered by how quick you're picking up on all this stuff compared to how long it took me to get this. You're in multiple sentences leapfrogging what took me several weeks. Yes, I think that's a very, very salient observation. The split that happens after the Cold War between realists and liberals happens where previously they are kind of on the same page. They might have different diagnostics of how we should react to the Soviet Union and such. But after the Cold War, a realist who's rather emphatic about it would probably look at NATO and say, well, the rationale for having NATO is now gone. The Soviet Union's imploded. We no longer have the superpower that we're vying against, so we can all pack up and go home. There's no reason to be spending all this money on here. Whereas liberals, because they see open markets and democratic elections as being a part of this peace process, rely on institutions to build out this free world. So like when the Cold War concludes, George H.W. Bush makes a concerted effort not to disband NATO. He wants to keep NATO together because he wants to keep Western Europe, the United Kingdom, and America as part of the same civilizational bloc. And you have folks like Bill Kristol that are wanting to do that too. I would say Bill Kristol is very liberal. He's very much a muscular liberalist of, we need to be enfranchising people in here, bump up NATO, all these different things. And when the Cold War concludes, you have a weird period for a while where the realists are all kind of discredited at the end of the Cold War, because in realist theory, the world should always have a homeostasis and be seeking a homeostasis. And so there's like this 10, 20-year period where it looks like the realists got it wrong, that Francis Fukuyama is right, the end of history is upon us. Everybody's agreed that liberal democracy and capitalism and neoliberalism are the way to go. And now it's just a question of just waiting for everybody to kind of acknowledge that Kittimer has exploded and the Klingon Empire is going to go, you know, join the Federation and all these things. Now what's happening is the realists are going, hey, look, it took a minute longer than we thought, but like China's now rising up to fill that void. Russia's now rising up to fill that void. It's not going to be a permanent American system dominating the world.
How would you classify Hillary Clinton?
Very much a liberal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then let me cut you off for a second there, because the reason I ask that is when I was going through that thing about the Cold War and saying after the Cold War was over, the liberals then said we need to do X, Y, and Z. And I was going to say, because of human rights reasons, but do we necessarily always take the liberals at their word? Because they seem very selective in where they want to enforce their human rights dogma. Now, mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter, I think, was pretty consistent. He didn't care mm-hmm. if you were a U.S. ally or not. He was, I think, pretty sincere about human rights. But mm-hmm. whereas, I mean, how can you get that up in arms about country A when countries X, Y, and Z are at least as bad as country A, but they just happen to be friends with the U.S.? Are the liberals hypocrites, or are some of them hypocrites? I mean, how do you answer that?
Maybe option A is they're straight up hypocrites. And I think that that would be something that certainly Marxists would point out, and a lot of realists would point out, that like Saudi Arabia is a really good example of something counter to that. Or even you can look at like World War II and go, we did team up with the Soviet Union to defeat the Nazis, which is a very realist thing to do, of like bad guy A is the worst guy or the one we're at war with, so we're going to team up with bad guy B, right? Whereas liberalism would not so much be in favor of that. Or you can point to the many times that we have subverted a democratic election abroad, like in Iran, where they had a democratically elected regime, but that regime wanted to nationalize the oil. And that was counter to the economic interests of the United States and the United Kingdom. So the CIA and MI6 sponsored a coup, pushed out their democratically elected regime, and installed a monarch, a despot, who is friendly to us. One way of looking at it is, yes, they're hypocrites. I think the other way of looking at it would be more like liberalism is not counterposed to realism. It's sort of a layer placed on top of it. So liberals are 70% realist and 30% liberal, in which case they would go, there are situations that are so overwhelmingly big that we have to rely on power politics, like allying with the Soviet Union, even though we disagree with them. But we're not always doing that. So I don't know. I can't see into their heart. But it's certainly a thing to keep in mind, because there are a lot of big counterexamples. I'll say with Biden, like when Biden's giving these flowery speeches about free world and Putin and Ukraine, and then in his next breath talking about maybe going down to Saudi Arabia to make sure that we can get that oil out of there, I'm like, do you not see these apparent contradictions here?
Yeah. So I wonder about that. And that makes me wonder. I mean, with the realists, I know what they're all about because they tell me. I understand their analysis. Right.
They're pretty upfront, yeah.
Right. So if a liberal like Biden gives me a pretty speech, but yet he leaves so much out of that pretty speech, what about this regime? What about that one? Then it makes me wonder, they're not being upfront with me. What are they really after? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, for all the policy papers they write and the books and speeches, given that I can't reconcile what they're saying with what they're doing half the time, what are they really after? Are they really just after all, just advancing American interests, but under a veneer of pretty sounding rhetoric? Or is it something else?
I don't know. I mean, like, I think another good example of this is the war in Iraq. I think pretty much everybody acknowledges that that was a disastrous conflict at this point. I don't think anybody thinks that was a great idea retrospectively. Kind of what you think was going on in the minds of Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush is a good prism for what you think is going on in the mind of liberals. Like in my case, now I have a high degree of Pollyanna and I tend to take people at their word until there's really direct evidence that they're lying to me. So in the case of Iraq, what I think was going on was George Bush and his cohorts really did believe all the liberal rhetoric that open markets and democracy are a good thing and we need to promote it abroad. And they really did think if we liberate Iraq, it will become a fellow democratic regime and it will be a stabilizing force in the Middle East and democracy will spread from Iraq to those other countries. So I think that they were doing a very ill-fated, bad application of liberal theory. But there are a lot of people, and I totally understand why, that are like, no, they just owned a lot of stock in oil and they just wanted to go in and get Enron rich. And like, Cheney owned stock in oil and he didn't divest himself of it. Like, I'm not going to push back on that, but it could be either one. I think like you look at like Bill Kristol, I don't know Bill. I've emailed him a few times. I don't think Bill's looking to make a buck off it. I think he really does believe that the world is better with a robust American presence and that, you know, building up NATO and all these things is the way to achieve peace. I think there are people that believe that. And I think there's other people that are using it as a smokescreen. I will admit that I don't know all the minutiae of the increasingly myriad scandals involving the Biden family and Ukraine, but it would seem to me that this conflict going on between Russia and Ukraine involves the Biden family and goes back to the Obama years and the Trump years. And I don't know what's going on there. And like, I think you could start looking at that going, all right, there's other forces here at work that would appear to be somewhat economic and self-serving.
What do you think, speaking to a libertarian audience, are the most significant and helpful insights that somebody can get by studying these various approaches?
I think for libertarians, the number one thing that you get out of this is being able to predict what authoritarian regimes are going to do. Because if you're a libertarian, you already have a pretty good idea of what you don't want to do at the national level, which is you are going to be a non-interventionist. You are probably going to be very skeptical of alliances, if not for pulling out of NATO entirely. So you already have your bearings on America, which is going to resemble a very large Switzerland. You know, that's kind of the Ron Paul foreign policy mechanism. So in that instance, IR theory is not going to be super helpful for you in terms of formulating where you want your policy to go, because you already have a good idea what that's going to do. But in terms of being able to predict what other countries are going to do, which are going to affect you, IR policy is useful. So for example, like looking at China, if you are going to look at world conflict and say that world conflict is primarily ideological, you're going to be trying to understand what China's doing based on communism. If you're looking at it in terms of Marxism, you're going to see things like China invading other countries as just them wanting to expand their markets. And if you're a realist, you're going to look at it and say China's trying to expand its zone of influence. And so you could look and go, hey, look, China's probably going to invade Taiwan because of X, or China's not apt to invade Taiwan because of X, or you know, Russia's going to stomp into Georgia. I think where I'm at on this is I am a realist when it comes to our rivals, and I'm a liberal when it comes to our allies. I think open markets are great. I think democracy is great. I'm very much with Ron Paul when it comes to non-intervention, but I think NATO, the European Union, the WTO, these are organizations which are broadly good at promoting values and maintaining values that we like abroad, right? But I don't think they apply to Putin and things like that. So when I look at Putin, I very much see him as a guy that is understood through the prism of realism. So like in 2008, George W. Bush announces that NATO is going to enfranchise Ukraine and Georgia. A month later, Putin invades Georgia. We do exercises under the Biden administration in November of this year in the Black Sea, military drills with the Ukrainian Navy. What happens? About 3 weeks later, they invade Ukraine. Not 3 weeks later, about 3 months later, they invade Ukraine. Because again, that would be the same thing as Canada and Russia doing joint drills in Lake Superior. We would react to that, right? So in terms of being able to assess what other countries are going to do and how we're going to get roped into that, that's where IR theory is useful to a libertarian.
So you said you did an episode of your podcast about this recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, how long did that one run?
It's about an hour and a half. I'd say normally I do like 45 minute to an hour episodes. That one was about an hour and a half. But I do get it. Like I get into risk. I talk about like how like risk applies to international relations theory and these various mitigating factors going on. But it did take a fair amount of information to work through.
Well, I want to, of course, recommend The Political Orphanage. And what do you number the episodes? What number is that one?
You know what? I kind of number them, but I'm getting rid of that. The episode that's pertinent to us is How to Prevent or Provoke Stupid Wars, which came out a couple of weeks ago. That's the stuff we're talking about. Another one that I think your audience in particular, Tom, would very much enjoy is I have one called, I think it's like Psychedelic Adventures or something to that effect. Hold on a minute. Let me pull it up.
Yeah, my audience would go for that. I don't even know what that's about.
Right.
But
Adventures in Psychedelic Drugs is a really fun episode. I brought on two friends for that. The first one, I used to do a show on Reason called Mostly Weekly,
yeah,
which was
I remember
a
that.
Funny satire thing. So my comedy writing partner from that, Sarah Siskind, is a very knowledgeable person in terms of biochemistry and neurology, if not personal experience in terms of psychedelic drugs. So I brought her on the first half of the program. We talked about how mushrooms affect you, where we stand in terms of policy, the palliative benefits of various psychedelic drugs. And then in the second one, I'm friends with a lady named Ayla, who is a very successful cam girl, which is to say a kind of porn star. She's a very smart lady, a very cool talker. Then I found out she did LSD every week for a year. And I was like, I would love to talk to you about the effects of that. So first half is me talking to a comedian about neurochemistry. Second half is me talking to a porn star about dropping acid. So it's a fun episode.
Oh, my gosh. You can't get everything on the Tom Woods Show. That's what you're learning now. You can't get everything. By the way, probably...
So one thing I'm beating Tom Woods in is talking to porn stars about acid. That's the one edge I've got over you.
You know, I don't know how many months ago it was, but I tend to do a lot of my podcast listening on Saturday mornings when I'm making breakfast for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I was listening, I don't know how I came upon it, but Jordan Peterson was interviewing somebody who was an expert, you know, on the medical side of psychedelic drugs and talking about their use, you know, for people with depression and stuff like that. They were talking about this, and he wasn't saying, well, this is the craziest, stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. He was very, very interested in it and supportive of the research that's been done. So there's a lot out there. So mm-hmm. I am also interested in that topic. So obviously, the Political Orphanage, people just go to a podcast app and find it, but you must have a website also.
Yeah, if you want to go to Political Orphanage, andrewheaton.tv is the way to do it on your browser.
Okay.
And otherwise, just put it into a podcast app, Political Orphanage, and come on board.
All right, very good. Well, Andrew, thanks so much for your time. Lots of fun talking.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
I'm going to get
always
back to you pleasure. About Scotland, by the way.
Please do. It's funny, like, I'm wanting to put roots down in Austin, Texas. I'm excited to be here. And I have friends that are like, well, you really shouldn't leave for 3 months if you're, and I'm like, yeah, but I have so many cool people that want to visit me in Scotland. It's not like I'm going to militate against that. I'll just be building my community in America while I'm in Scotland. So come over. That'd be great. I would love to show you around.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. All right. I'll get back to you. Thanks so much for today.
Absolutely.
All right, everybody. That's going to do it for today. Rest of the week, I got a couple of pretty darn good ones. Tomorrow, our friend Heine Zietelmann returns because he has a brand new book, The Power of Capitalism. And it's maybe the best short little history-based book making the case against central planning and various other forms of socialism and making the case for a market economy. You think, I've heard this all before, but he goes into case after case. So China, Africa, South America, he talks about the case of Sweden. He talks about North versus South Korea, East versus West Germany. It's a really, really well done book. He also talks about the way the market economy improves the general standard of living. And he talks about why the intellectuals hate capitalism. So we're going to have a great conversation about that. Then our final episode of the week will be with comedian Lee Camp, who 8 years ago got his own program, Redacted Tonight. And he no longer has that. He's been censored, not quite out of existence, but he's been pretty heavily censored. And it's that he doesn't hold the exact company policy, let's say, with the company being the U.S. government, on the Ukraine situation. Obviously, he's against the invasion of Ukraine, as 99% of the world population is, but he's not going for the saintly NATO versus the uniquely wicked Russians. He's just not buying that because that doesn't correspond to reality. And for not buying that, he's paid a heavy price. So we're going to be talking to him. So if you like and appreciate what goes on here at the Tom Woods Show, join me over at supportinglisteners.com. And in return, you will get, as you will see on that page at supportinglisteners.com, not only an amazing list of goodies that I give to those people who support this program, but you have my promise to give you the most varied and best quality libertarian podcast that I can possibly make. So thanks, everybody, for your support. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.